Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio. I'm your host, Paul Garcia, and today it's my pleasure to be speaking with the famous YouTuber, a former television personality, and the author of multiple books like Thursday Night Pizza and Baking Secrets from a Bread Monk, the Breadhead himself, a Benedictine monk from St. Bede Abbey in Peru, Illinois, Father Dominic, more commonly known as the Bread Monk. Father, thank you very much for coming on to the show today.
My pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Of course, the pleasure is all ours. So, you had your first experience baking bread when you were in fifth grade. What about that has led to this lifelong dedication to being, as you say, a breadhead?
Well, I think I grew up in a house where baking bread was like a normal thing. Okay. For a lot of people, you know, baking is a mystery, you know, but in my family, my mother baked all the time and getting homemade bread was, you know, kind of the norm. I feel especially that she made it sound like it was no big deal because to her it wasn't. She won dozens and dozens of ribbons at the Heart of Illinois Fair in Peoria. And so that was just like a really normal thing for her. So in fifth grade, I come back from class and from school, and I tell Mom, I have to make some kind of food to share that comes from a French-speaking country. And my mom said, oh, we'll make French bread. That's easy. And a lot of people would be like, let's make French dressing. That's easy, you know, French toast or something. You know? No, French bread was like no big deal. And so she guided me through it. She made me do all the work myself. I made two baguettes and took them to class with a cutting board and her best knife. There was dire consequences if I lost the knife. And then she got unsalted butter like they serve in France. And then we had, some kind of homemade, maybe apricot preserves or something. And I served this to my classmates. And I don't remember serving it. I don't remember slicing it. But what I do remember is the cutting board covered in crumbs and completely empty. And the butter destroyed, you know, like fifth graders would do, as you can imagine, you know. And you know, they ate all the jam and so forth. And there's that kind of that satisfaction of making something that everybody really enjoyed. Because some other people brought in foods that people didn't eat all of, you know, that they didn't like it as well. This, everybody really enjoyed. And that satisfaction of creating something that was enjoyed and admired by other people, you know, when you're in fifth grade, you're looking for stuff like that. You're looking for things where you can excel and do well. And so I got interested in baking at that early age, and that became just kind of a part of my character over the next, you know, 10 years or so. By the time I was in high school, I was baking a lot more often and found that to be a really satisfying activity.
Interesting. So it all started with that project in fifth grade and your mom's incredible baking talents and how normal that was in your household. Yeah. I'm curious, where did your mom get into baking? What was her ethnicity, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, my mom was Irish on one side and Austrian on the other. And of course, that meant that, you know, Italian soda bread. My grandmother was a great baker as well. She also makes this, used to make this Easter bread that's called patitsa most often. We called it pavidica. It's the Austrian version. Most often has a really sweet filling. In my family, it's a savory bread, and it's got bacon and chopped walnuts and beaten egg on the inside as the filling. And it gets rolled up and coiled into this shape, and it's a great big huge loaf. And that was always a tradition at Easter time, was to make this savory Austrian bread. And that was just one of the first things I learned how to make, was to make this pavidica. And then also, when I was a senior in high school, we did Fiddler on the Roof as the spring musical. And so for the cast party, I brought in a great big challah. You know, a big challah loaf braided and beautifully made. I was kind of proud of, I got to admit.
Right.
Because that's a classic Jewish bread. So that's kind of how I started. I kind of thought in terms of myself being a baker. You know, that was became part of my identity.
From what little I know about baking, challah bread is a sophisticated type of thing to bake, is it not?
Well, it's the braiding technique that's difficult for a lot of people. You've got to be able to roll the ropes out, you know, perfectly even, the same length, and get them to braid evenly. And that does require some skill. And I have to admit, over the years, I've gotten, you know, more and more complex. And I do crown braids now and six strand braids and all sorts of more complex bread weaving, just because I like manipulating dough and I like, you know, beautiful patterns. So I think that's a way to kind of put something special on the table.
Sure. And for the people listening, you know, we understand this is Catholic Spirit Radio. I'm speaking to a monk here. You're in your habit. We will talk about the life of a monk and being a monk and more things religious. But first, I think it's very interesting to be talking about this baking life. And I'd like to ask a few more questions about it. How does it feel when you make bread or anything and everyone just devours it? Maybe you could talk about that a little more.
Well, I have to say that even though bread baking in and of itself is not automatically a spiritual experience, it can be, certainly. But because I'm a monk and because I'm so steeped in scripture, anytime I start working with dough, I'm thinking about the manna in the wilderness and the multiplication of the loaves and Ezekiel's bread and his prophecy and the Eucharist above all, of course. And so all of that's kind of with me while I'm working with bread. And there's always this sense of, you know, kind of the feeding of everybody's hungers. And we're hungry for a lot of different things. You know, we're hungry for food, but we're hungry for fellowship too. And the word companion or company comes from the Latin cum panum, with bread. So when we say company's coming, it means we're going to break bread with them. If someone's your companion on the journey of life, you break your bread with them. It's in the word itself.
Right.
And so there's this kind of fundamental sense of fellowship and joining with others in baking that's just built right into it. You make bread, you break bread with other people. If you know, you could eat a whole loaf of bread by yourself. I certainly could. But who does, really? I mean, you cut it in slices, you tear off hunks, whatever. It's always something that begs to be shared rather than eaten in solitude. And so I find that it's just automatically bread is something that always reaches out to other people.
Right, absolutely. And bread is delicious, and it's like, I think of after funerals, every single funeral, every wedding, it's like you always get together with everyone afterward and you eat. It's just the universal bonding activity is eating. And everyone loves bread. Bread's a staple in all big meals for large gatherings.
And you find that in the scriptures especially, that a lot of Jesus' most important teachings take place at a meal. You know, he's at a banquet with Matthew. You know, I mean, he's at supper at Simon's house, and the woman comes and anoints his feet. There's the, you know, he's at supper at Mary and Lazarus and Martha's and Lazarus's house. You know, and the week before Holy Week, and there he is. You know, at a banquet, and so a lot of important teachings take place at meals, and that was significant for him, and that's just been taken over by Christian culture. It's just natural for us.
Right. It sure is fascinating. Whenever I read the Gospels, I get hungry because bread is mentioned so often. You watch any of these shows like The Chosen, even The Passion, and it makes the bread look really good. It's really interesting. When you eat bread, it just seems like the most sacred food. And I'm curious, do you know why the host, the Eucharist, the Holy Eucharist looks the way that it does? Why is it in a circle? Why is it small? Is it our guess as to what the bread from heaven, the manna, looked like in the Old Testament, or is it some other reason?
Well, you have to remember that in the very early centuries of the church, bread looked like pita bread. The unleavened bread that we served at Mass was like a pita bread that got pieces torn off of. Okay. It wasn't until because congregations were small, it was house churches. You know, that we didn't have big cathedrals because we were a persecuted church. We met in people's houses. Once the church became larger and congregations got larger, that became really impractical, and it made it much more difficult. And so over the centuries, a different form of unleavened bread evolved, you know, into this kind of, you know, mass-produced host, round because that was considered a symbol of perfection. Mm. Okay. And then, and small because you might have a cathedral that had, you know, 600,000-800,000 people in it, you know, and so they had to do this in a practical way that wouldn't take up as much space. Then, of course, the practice also of reserving the sacrament becomes problematic. It has to be something that can be held in a vessel. And so a lot of that evolved primarily in a practical sense because our congregations got so much larger. But in the earlier church, it was actually bread that was brought. And, by the way, bread that was brought not by the priests, not provided by a religious community. The people brought the bread and brought it as part of the offering. That they had a business of bringing the presentation of the gifts at the offertory. People brought bread they had made to be used. In fact, we find a letter to, I think it's John Chrysostom, but I don't know that for certain, but a woman who says, who wrote to the bishop and said, I went to Mass and I recognized that the bread that I received as the Eucharist was bread that I baked, and I knew it couldn't be Jesus because it was something I made and it wasn't holy enough. And the priest had to say, it's not about your holiness, it's about God's transforming power, and that your bread is in fact transformed. And so that gives us the idea that people brought bread in as part of the offerings that was actually used in the Eucharist, okay? That was the earliest practice in the church. Eventually that evolves as the church becomes somewhat more institutional.
Very interesting. So technically speaking, Father, when you say a Mass, it's not absolutely necessary that you have an exact kind of host, an exact kind of bread with an exact kind of recipe used to make
it. Well, actually, the recipe does matter because it has to be unleavened and it can only be made out of wheat. That's fundamentally, that's by canon law practice. If you want to have a valid Mass, you've got to celebrate with bread that is made with wheat and is unleavened. Okay, you can't use something other than wheat, and you can't add other ingredients. It has to be unadulterated, because what we're using is an imitation of the Passover bread, which was also unleavened bread, of course. We use the same bread that Jesus used, which was unleavened bread and was made only with flour and water. And that was how Jesus did it, and we do it in imitation of him.
Interesting. I guess it makes sense that it has to be unleavened, and it has to be wheat. However, the fine details of that recipe can change, probably from parish to parish, correct? Because I've been to different churches, and I'm positive that this tastes different than the other one. You know, this one tastes a little more whole grainy, wheaty or something.
Well,
than the other.
That is true. You can use white flour or wheat flour. I mean, whole wheat flour, okay? And it might be one that has cracked wheat in it, but you can't have any other grain. You can't add rice flour or cornmeal or honey or brown sugar or anything like that. It can only be wheat flour. It could be white. It could be wheat, 100% whole grain. But it can't be any other kind of flour. And the Catholic Church is very strict about this. There are other denominations that they use bread, and it might be unleavened bread, but they might have other ingredients in it. But in the Catholic Church, the tradition is, going all the way back to apostolic times, is that we only use unleavened bread only made with wheat.
Mm-hmm. I see. And practically speaking, though, if a church did not have its typical host refilling that week, they could use bread made that is unleavened and made of wheat from the parishioners.
Absolutely.
They could. Absolutely. They could still do that.
And I've been to Masses like that.
Really?
I've been to Masses like that. Yeah, that's definitely allowed. Yeah. It's very strict that it has to be, you know, wheat flour and has to, with no other ingredients, and just made with water. You can't use milk or add oil or anything like that. And you make an unleavened bread and you roll it out very thin and it bakes very quickly. You can do the whole process in about 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. In fact, in the Jewish tradition, if you're going to make matzah for Passover, it has to be done within 18 minutes, because any longer than that, it's possible for the dough to start to ferment.
Huh.
And so the rabbinic law is very strict on that.
Interesting. I'm learning a lot here. One thing that I thought was interesting is, since Vatican II, from what I understand of it, it seems like they decided to let different cultures express different ways of worship within the Mass.
Right.
Different languages, slightly different practices to show praise to God and the Eucharist. But one thing they have just said no to is, in Asian countries where rice is kind of the symbol of life more than wheat is, and they wanted to use some rice paddy instead of a wheat host.
Right.
They said, no, it has to be unleavened and wheat.
Right.
I think that's interesting. Yeah, that's an important detail.
That's just an unchanged tradition since apostolic times. And there are certain things that are just non-negotiable, and that happens to be one of them. I mean, the external expression of worship, you know, could involve dance and various styles of music and certain instruments and so forth. And that we call that process enculturation, and that's, you know, it can be a good thing. Obviously, the introduction of music forms that are familiar to a particular culture can be helpful with evangelization and helping people express their spirituality in a way that's comfortable to them. But always we want to do that in a way that maintains, you know, the discipline of the church, and that whatever those practices are not somehow associated with any form of idolatry or pagan worship.
Right, right. It's a tricky balance to some people, and more traditional Catholics can kind of get up in arms about seeing these types of things.
Right, and we want to be careful that we preserve tradition, but at the same time not straitjacket. You know,
right.
And just having that balance between the two. I always tell people, you know, there's two kinds of fools in the church. I read this years ago. The people who say, this is old, therefore it is good. And the people who say, this is new, therefore it is better. Neither of those are wisdom. Okay. That the church constantly holds on to its tradition and at the same time reinvents itself. And the process and the guidance of the Holy Spirit and at work in the magisterium is the way that we make sure that that balance is maintained.
Understood. Well said. And back to kind of what you were saying about just the feeling you get when people devour what you created in the kitchen, more specifically in the oven. It makes me think to my girlfriend, who's a fantastic cook and a baker. And it's just the absolute best trade-off between the two of us because, like you, she gets a great feeling from making delicious foods that get devoured. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely love devouring those foods. It's a wonderful thing. Have you been finding joy from baking for the past few decades? Is this a passion of yours?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't like to go very long without baking. I find that I get crabby. You know, people say, oh, baking is such great therapy. No, baking is what you do so you don't need therapy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the thing that keeps you balanced. One of the things I like about baking is that it's a very tactile activity. You know, your senses are being used. You know, there's the smell of the yeast, the eggs, the milk, the, you know, the fermentation process, even flour itself has a particular smell. There's this, the sensation of the dough under your hands was very specific, you know, when it's in its batter stage and then when it's in its firming up stage. And then when you're kneading it, there's a process by which you get to the point like, oh, okay, now I'm done kneading because it's got a particular springy quality. It's all very tactile, you know, it has a period when you have to rest, you know, there's a period when it gets punched down. There's all these different kind of metaphors for life that are involved in this whole process. And then, you know, I like to point out to my students, when they don't like, when there's rules, you know, we have rules in the school or rules in the church or whatever. I said, the only reason that bread rises is because it has a pan to restrict it.
That's, you know, good.
That without the the sides of the pan, what happened? Then the dough just spreads out. And so that limit is part of the process of making the dough rise and become more lofty. And so, you know, for us to take our true shape, yes, the Lord puts limits on us, okay? Institutions put limits on us. Why? It's so that the whole society can rise higher, you know, and that's kind of part of the process of finding out, okay, well, you know, what are those essential limits and are there ways in which we, you know, can not make use of them? I mean, there's a lot of loaves that get baked free form on a pan. Sure, absolutely. But at the same time, you know, there's that sense of, you know, recipes have limitations. You know, you add too much salt or too much sugar, you don't have bread anymore. You know, and so finding that balance is really a good life lesson. If we're reflective about what we're doing, recognizing I need balance in my life, I need guidance, like I need a recipe, but I also need the freedom of creativity. All of those ideas come together in the baking process.
That's got to be one of my favorite quotes just right out of the gate, that bread rises because of the pan's limits that it imposes on that bread. Yeah. That's genius. Father, you speak like an artist, a poet, an engineer, and a chemist. And we're going to hear a whole lot more of that in just one second. But first, here's a quick few words from our beloved sponsors.
You're listening to Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio.
Hi, this is Debbie Giorgiani from EWTN's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie. I'll be hosting Catholic Spirit Radio's Carathon on April 12th, 13th, and 14th. Yes, you'll hear me live on air, specifically speaking to you, the Catholic Spirit Radio listeners in Central and Northern Illinois. This will be the first time that Catholic Spirit Radio is having a live broadcast, so it's going to be a blast. Besides me, you'll also get to hear from a lot of people dropping by the station to make their donations. Plus, since our theme for the Carathon is Jesus, we trust in you, we'll be talking and learning lots about divine mercy. It's sure to be an exciting 3 days. Catholic Spirit Radio is an outstanding and important voice in your community, and we must keep it on the air. Please join me in this effort because we need Catholic radio now more than ever. Funds are needed to maintain and update equipment and pay the monthly expenses. We need your support, especially during these days. So save the date, Catholic Spirit Radio's Carathon, April 12th through the 14th.
Join Holy Trinity and Historic St. Pat's Parishes in Bloomington in welcoming internationally renowned authors, speakers, and theologians, Drs. Scott Hahn and John Bergsma, as they make a rare speaking appearance to Central Illinois. This special event is being hosted by Holy Trinity Church Church in Bloomington, Saturday, April 29th, 8:45 to 3:30. Seating is limited, so please register now. Don't miss out on this inspiring and blessed event. Learn more at the Holy Trinity website at hsp-ht.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio. I am your host, Paul Garcia, and I'm speaking with Father Dominic the Bread Monk. Father, you had a TV show on public television for a while. Please tell me all about that.
Well, I had a classmate from high school who knew that I was a baker. She was going to the PBS station in St. Louis to pitch some ideas to them, and she said, I'm going to mention your name. And I said, yeah, go ahead. Like, I'm thinking, nothing's going to come of that, right? And surprisingly, they were interested. They came up and came to watch me teach. They wanted to see me kind of live and without a net. And so they came. I didn't have to change my curriculum at all. They came on the day that I was teaching the multiplication of the loaves. And in that particular lecture, I was talking about different kinds of breads and how they symbolize different kinds of Christian ministry. Well, there are people who are raisin bread people, and there are people who are pumpernickel Christians, and there are, you know, garlic bread Christians, and there are rye bread Christians, and kind of each of those interpreted. And of course, the kids are calling out different kinds of breads, and I'm bringing up different kinds of breads, and they're sitting in the back there in their suits in the tiny school desk, you know, and scribbling furiously as I'm, you know, talking about different kinds of breads. And, after I taught literally for this 50-minute class, we went to my office and I gave them homemade herb tea and some shortbread cookies. And they said, we think you got what it's take. We want to offer you a TV show. I mean, like literally like that easy. So God kind of opened that path to me. My first reaction was to say no, because I thought that's just not a monk thing. You know, I mean, that being out there and famous and, you know, I just didn't think that was where I wanted to go. And my abbot pointed something out to me, Abbot Roger at that time. He said, this could be our best and maybe only chance to show a real 21st century monk to the public. So not a Hollywood version or a sitcom version or a cartoon version, but the real, what a real monk looks like. And you can tell real monk stories about us and our life together while you are doing this baking thing. And so I said, yeah, but what I told him was, you can't use the word star. You can say that I'm the host of the show, but you can't ever use the word star.
Just because you take this of humility. Yeah,
it's just a monk thing. But I mean, we don't like words like star and famous and stuff like that. We're just not kind of the way we go about things. And so I said, you know, I would just prefer to, you know, just refer to me as the host. And they were very respectful, and they, you know, made sure that I was referred to as Father Dominic, and we actually would stop taping in the middle of the day so I could do noon prayer. You know, they would say, okay, it's time for noon prayer, and everything would shut down, and I'd go out on the back deck, on the back loading dock with my prayer book and, you know, do noon prayer. So they were very respectful. And so I did that for 3 years. I reached a point where it was becoming so demanding, it was interfering with my monastic life. And so I stopped doing that because it was just taking too much time and energy, and I wasn't really capable of, at that time, I was really capable of balancing those things. And I found myself, you know, I was tired of praying in airports and hotel rooms instead of with my brothers. And it was hard on me, you know, when I was have to do a 2-week media tour and have to come up with 2 weeks worth of class lessons and substitutes and all that kind of stuff. That it just got to be too much. So after I had done it for 3 years, so we were 3 years on the air, and then there were another 3 years of reruns and so forth. So I was on the air about 6 years, but I continued to do pledge specials for PBS and continued to write cookbooks. I did find a publisher that was interested in continuing to let me write cookbooks. And so since I started this whole business, I think my last one was my 11th book. So I've been doing a lot of baking over the years.
Holy cow.
What's nice is that people think of me as not just as a bread person, but they think of me as a bread monk. And I get invited to parishes and even civic groups in the hopes that I will come with not just a demonstration, but a spiritual message as well. And so I really feel like I'm kind of continuing the process of evangelization, even when I'm doing bread demonstrations. And I have to say, even while I was on the air at public television, you know, people could see just I wore the habit. You know, I talked about spiritual realities. I did not you know, I did not proselytize. I didn't, you know, try to, you know, condemn or convert. I just simply witnessed to what my life was as a monk and a baker. And we got lots of mail from people saying, you know, thank you for proclaiming the gospel just by the way your demeanor is. And I got a letter one time from a gentleman from Texas, and you could tell that he was not Roman Catholic, but he is prayer group. He says, I just want you to know that our prayer group was lifting you up to Jesus. You know, and it was clear this kind of a Protestant background, uh-huh. You know, evangelical background. It says, and we just want you to thank you for doing the Lord's work on public television. I mean, it was this beautiful ecumenical moment in which he was acknowledging, you know, that what I was doing was a positive force for the gospel. And I have found that to be true, that a lot of people said they tuned in not just for the recipes, but for the content.
You mentioned to John and I before the show started that your family, it seemed like everyone was on board when you decided to become a monk back when you were just 22 years old.
Yeah.
What led
to
that?
Well, I will say, father was not so good on this. Mm. My father was not so keen on this. It took him a while to come around to the whole monk thing, I have to say. My father had big dreams for me when I was younger, and I had really good grades, and I had studied both French and Spanish in grade school and high school. And so my father thought, he thought I should be a corporate lawyer specializing in international business law. It was like that specific, if you can imagine, that specific of a vision. And so we kind of had we were at loggerheads a little bit about what I was going to do. And then because I majored in theater. So he's
my goodness, he's a world apart.
Yeah, really. And then after 2 years in theater, and I was very successful and, you know, had all kinds of great successes in technical theater and in acting and so forth. And then I said, and I'm going to join the monastery. Then that blew him away, you know.
It's like, come on, you're doing good in theater. I'll get on board.
Well, part of the problem for him was he had the Hollywood view or the sitcom view of monasticism, where you're in a darkened room with a single candle and you're hitting yourself with a whip while you kneel on rocks, you know, whatever. And it just didn't have a realistic sense of what I said, Dad, we teach a high school, you know, I mean, it's let be realistic about what I'm headed towards, you know, and the more he came to the monastery, the more he met other monks, the more he saw the work we do, as well as the prayer we had, he came on board. And eventually he was very, very happy and proud that I was a monk.
When did you hear that calling? Because I know that discernment's an interesting thing. Like I, for instance, with myself, you know, of course, any good Catholic man will, I think at some point or another, discern, you know, maybe I'm called to be a priest.
Right, right.
But a lot of the time it's like, for me, it's like, no, I mean, no offense or anything.
Right,
it's like,
right.
No, that is absolutely not my personal calling. But I guess, yeah, how did you discern that, and why? Did you always feel like this was your calling?
Well, I felt a calling towards religious life even in grade school. But it wasn't until I got into high school that I really realized I was being drawn, in particular, that I was being drawn to community. That I realized I wasn't really all that interested in being a priest alone in a parish. You know, or even with one other, you know, priest in the parish. That I really wanted a community life. I wanted to be a part of a larger group that had this larger purpose. And that was really the thing that drew me to monastic life, was having this larger sense of your purpose in life with other people who were like-minded, and that being a part of that was really what I was drawn to. And so I visited my monastery, St. Bede Abbey in Peru, Illinois, when I was in high school. And in between my junior and senior year, I was visiting the monastery. I was standing out in front of the gymnasium, looking out over the North Orchard. And I thought to myself, wow, this is it. I thought that it was like a bell went off, or like a snap-top type model came together. You know, that click, you know, when you put on the sunroof or whatever, you know. And I thought, wow, this could be the place I'm going to be for the rest of my life. And then, of course, my next thought was, all right, God, get me a date to prom first, okay? Get me through high school. I'm not ready for this now, you know. But it became stronger and stronger as I went through college. I spent 2 years at a drama school and then realized, no, I really am meant to join the monastery. And so I transferred to a seminary at that time, and then after college, joined the monastery.
And you got two master's degrees during that time, correct?
No, that was my college years. The two master's degrees came in graduate school. After I joined the monastery, went through postulancy and novitiate, and was in my juniorate, I expressed an interest in going on for the priesthood. And then they sent me away to graduate school at St. Meinrad in Southern Illinois Southern Indiana, and that's where I got the two master's degrees, and became ordained. And that was in 1983 that I was ordained. Excuse me, 1992 that I was ordained. 83 was when I joined the monastery. So.
I see. I see. Quite a story. Quite a story and quite a journey. A lot of traveling. It seemed like it never stopped even doing that TV show. Apparently, you're flying all over the place. And a busy, busy life sounds like you've had.
Well, surprisingly, a lot of people say, you know, oh, you're just so busy. You're just so busy. I don't really feel that busy. I think it's because monastic life, because it's so orderly, because five times a day a bell rings and everybody's got to shut up, mm-hmm. you know, that you go to prayer, that you're expected at a certain point in the day to be in silence with the Word of God, you know, that it doesn't feel like it's nonstop, go, go, go. There are these periods when, no, I have this other thing that keeps me grounded. People would say, you know, wow, is it, you know, weird when you're on TV and you get whatever you want and then you go back to the monastery? And it's like, no, I just go back to the monastery and I clean the toilet backstage because nobody's done that while I'm gone, you know. and I go back to my regular monastic life, and that's the great grounding that life gave me. And that was the thing I valued, which is why I ended up, you know, giving up the television stuff. I now only do, like I say, pledge specials. You know, every few years I'll produce one, and I'll still go, and, you know, like next month I'll be going to St. Louis to tape some pledge breaks, and Sacramento wants me to come out and do some taping there too. So I'll do that on occasion, but it's not, you know, it's on a schedule that matches my monastic community's needs rather than it being based on what the network wants, if you know
sure.
what I mean. So.
Right, right. One thing that I found very interesting in doing research about you, and you've already mentioned it a little bit, is your ability to describe different kinds of Catholics as different kinds of breads.
Right.
I don't really know what in the world that means, but assuming you know probably 100 times more bread types than I do, could I tell you a type of bread that I prefer? And
okay.
you can tell me what
okay.
that means?
You can tell me what kind of bread, what's the bread
okay.
that you really like?
Well, all right. Well, first of all, I love the dinner rolls at like Logan's Roadhouse, but that's not even the type
about.
Of bread.
Okay. Well, no, that counts as a toco bread, but it,
sure.
But is there some other kind of bread that you're thinking
Pumpernickel's
of?
Pumpernickel's awesome.
Okay. Pumpernickel. This is a great story. Pumpernickel was developed during a siege in a city, and they were running out of wheat flour. And so a baker got mashed potatoes and cornmeal and rye and anything else he could think of to extend it, because it was a necessity. They were going to starve if they didn't figure out other ways to make bread. And what he got was this dense, deeply flavorful, you know, dark, dark bread. So when I talk about a pumpernickel Christian, it's somebody who doesn't complain about what God didn't give them. What they do is they take what God did give them and turn it into something unique and wonderful, and not perhaps what everyone expects, but still what's necessary for the moment. So I think of pumpernickel Christians are like anybody who teaches CCD or works in a Catholic grade school. You never have enough money. You never have the resources you need. And yet the faith gets passed on. They don't get everything they want, but whatever they get, they use that to do the Lord's work, and that's a pumpernickel Christian. So,
and sometimes the people who receive that teaching, it's even more flavorful than the normal stuff.
Exactly, exactly. The fact that, I mean, in my own experience, you know, that teaching my students on the stage how to do things on a budget, you know, teaches them far more than if we could just buy everything we wanted, mm-hmm. you know, and that developing those skills, that's a very positive thing. And I always try to do that. In a Catholic context, I say, look, the Holy Spirit has given us these gifts. We're going to use them with the gifts that we've received. I'm not going to complain about we don't have the best lighting or we don't have the best tools or whatever. We're going to use what we got and create something beautiful. And then that's a lesson they can learn. So,
What about white bread? Do you have anything for that?
Well, I'll tell you what, when I talk about white bread, you know, when you think about white bread, if you've ever had homemade white bread, I mean, just ordinary white bread recipe, not even a fancy recipe with lots of eggs or oil or sugar or anything, just a plain loaf of bread. To me, that's that Christian who does ordinary things with extraordinary love. You can go buy a loaf of white bread, even a decent loaf of white bread, okay? I mean, a really good one, perhaps, in some artisan bakeries. But you choose to make it yourself. That's the person who does these ordinary, everyday things with extraordinary love. And that's a kind of witness. That's a kind of evangelization that's just as powerful as preaching in a foreign nation or, you know, being an activist or whatever, that by our everyday lives, we can demonstrate, you know, extraordinary love. I mean, St. Teresa of Calcutta says that all the time. You know, do ordinary things with extraordinary love. That's what I think of as a white bread Christian, you know, so...
It's easy to see why those guys said you should have your own TV show after listening to you talk about this exact topic, relating different kinds of Catholics to different kinds of breads.
One of the things that is one of my favorite reflections is about raisin bread. Because to focus on the raisin itself, the raisin does not remember the pruner's knife on the vine. And the raisin doesn't remember long, hot, you know, summer days. And the raisin doesn't remember like cold rains in the fall, or that, you know, the raisin doesn't remember the long, slow process of drying out and diminishment and desiccation. All that the raisin remembers is that the grape was sweet, and that's what it passes on. And so the raisin bread Christian is that person who doesn't hang on to the pain of the past. They take what is sweetest, and that's what they pass on. It's the person who doesn't like complain about their life, you know, how in the past, you know, all these horrible things happened to me in my whole life, and oh, whoa, 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 me. Instead, they remember what's sweet, and that's what they pass on to other people, to their children. And so that's that. I try to look for meaning in these recipes and these breads. And say, okay, what kind of person can you be specifically? If you've had a life that's had some suffering, well, then okay, maybe that's the kind of bread you're meant to be. You know, whereas if you're a person who's got a really, really strong faith, well, maybe then you're garlic bread. You know, that can smell it a mile away. You know, everybody's got their own gifts, and there's probably a bread that goes with that, and that can tell you that it's okay to be that bread for the world.
Mm-hmm. That is genius. I love that. That is, you need to have a YouTube video where you go through these. I mean, you really do. I noticed on your YouTube, you have a bunch of videos about 9 years ago and nothing. And then one 2 years ago and then nothing again.
Well, I should
Who's
say.
Who's in charge of the YouTube?
I should say, we have. I do have a whole new set of YouTube videos, which is on my publisher's website, Reedy Press.
Ah.
The Reedy Press website is reedypress.com. And I have a whole other series there. Part of the struggle with YouTube is that YouTube doesn't want me using my high school's system to post things because of the firewall or something. And there's some weird thing that it doesn't like me to try to do things on my own website. It's very, very odd.
Right.
And so I may end up having to get a new channel just to figure out a way to start posting new content. I would like to start posting more spiritual kinds of things and more of these kinds of reflections because I do think people are hungry for them. And I like the idea of, you know, talking about a recipe and then how it was used within Catholic culture, you know, how a particular kind of bread was used for a festival or to convey a particular spiritual meaning. Mm-hmm. And I think that's people are hungry for that kind of content to know more about their Catholic culture.
Right. They are hungry for it. No pun intended.
Yeah.
And I am hungry to ask a few more questions to you, Father. And we'll do that here in just a minute. But first, here are a few quick words from our beloved sponsors.
You're listening to Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio.
Join Holy Trinity and historic St. Pat's parishes in Bloomington in welcoming internationally renowned authors, speakers, and theologians, Drs. Scott Hahn and John Bergsma, as they make a rare speaking appearance to Central Illinois. This special event is being hosted by Holy Trinity Church in Bloomington Saturday, April 29th, 8:45 to 3:30. Seating is limited, so please register now. Don't miss out on this inspiring and blessed event. Learn more at the Holy Trinity website at hsp-ht.org.
Has an abortion experience left you feeling empty and alone? Rachel's Vineyard Retreat offers healing for those who struggle with the emotional and spiritual pain. This retreat is for mothers and fathers, whether single or married, and for grandparents, siblings, or anyone suffering the effects of an abortion loss. Confidentially register now for the March 24th through 26th retreat by calling 309-264-1489 or by emailing rvrpeoria@gmail.com.
Wondering about your next step? Ashley was in school and pregnant when she reached out to the Pregnancy Resource Center. Would she be judged? Would she be accepted? What she found at LAPRC was a team of people who were committed to providing excellent care and compassionate support to those facing pregnancy decisions through authentic relationships that display grace, honor life, and foster community. If you or someone you know is in a situation like Ashley, or if you want to help support women and families in our community, You can find us at pregnancyresourcecenter.org.
Hi, this is Debbie Giorgiani from EWTN's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie. I'll be hosting Catholic Spirit Radio's Carathon on April 12th, 13th, and 14th. Yes, you'll hear me live on air, specifically speaking to you, the Catholic Spirit Radio listeners in Central and Northern Illinois. This will be the first time that Catholic Spirit Radio is having a live broadcast, so it's going to be a blast. Besides me, you'll also get to hear from a lot of people dropping by the station to make their donations. Plus, since our theme for the Carathon is Jesus, We Trust in You, we'll be talking and learning lots about divine mercy. It's sure to be an exciting 3 days. Catholic Spirit Radio is an outstanding and important voice in your community, and we must keep it on the air. Please join me in this effort because we need Catholic Radio now more than ever. Funds are needed to maintain and update equipment and pay the monthly expenses. We need your support, especially during these days. So save the date, Catholic Spirit Radio's Carathon, April 12th through the 14th.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio. I'm your host, Paul Garcia, and I am here with the bread monk himself, Father Dominic. Father, the conversation has been great so far. Let's talk a little bit more about the source and summit of our Catholic faith, the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. It is bread, and it becomes truly Jesus, body, blood, soul, and divinity. Mm-hmm. How amazing is that? And what does that feel like when you do that consecrating?
That's the expression that I have read years ago and which has kind of, you know, stayed with me and even almost haunts me a little bit is, I'm going to lose my composure here a little bit. The blessing to raise up bread and bring down God. That blessing, the I, the unworthy servant of God, have the ability to do that, you know, in this remarkable exchange of grace. You know, and that is something that I can bring as a priest, you know, to a congregation, to people. It's one of the most astonishing blessings in the world. For me, that and the confessional really are the real pillars of my priesthood, because those are the places where you meet people most directly. You meet the most people at the Eucharist, and you meet people the most personally in the confessional. And so those two together become really the pillars of Christian ministry as far as a priest is concerned. Because the majority of your congregation, where do they see you? They see you at Mass. You know, they might see you in the hospital when their mother is sick. They might see you, you know, in the confessional, one hopes. But it's really at the Eucharist they see you most often. And that's why you got to bring your A game. You know, that we should never be celebrating Mass on autopilot. There's an expression in Latin. It's age quod agis. Do what you are doing. When you're celebrating the Eucharist, don't be thinking about something else you got to be doing or what the next thing is in the Mass. Do the thing that you're doing right now. So that what you're focused on, it's a principle of mindfulness that everybody makes a big deal, like Buddhism and invented it. But that whole concept of being focused on the thing that is your ministry now, you know, that's very much a part of Catholic spirituality. And certainly for the priesthood is that whatever you're doing in the Eucharist, give yourself to that 100%. And what's nice about that, I mean, I think from the standpoint of the laity, and I tell people about this all the time. I teach my freshmen this when I do juniors and I teach sacraments. I teach this as well. One of the ways to make the Mass much more meaningful is that, remember that idea about bringing the bread up, like this woman brought her own bread and it was used for the Eucharist, okay? That's true of ourselves, that when we see the people carrying the gifts up, or we see them brought over from even from the side table by a server, okay, we should be putting ourselves on the altar as well. We should be offering ourselves along with the bread and the wine. And what we want is the same thing that happens to the Eucharistic species happens to us. God will transform us into his image and likeness and return ourselves to ourselves. That we put ourselves on the altar to be transformed into Jesus, and then it's returned to us. Just like the Eucharist comes back to us, we receive communion and God becomes within us. In that same sense, my true self gets transformed on the altar and returned to me with the Eucharist so I can be who I'm really supposed to be, mm-hmm. You know, and my identity as a beloved child of God. And that transformation takes place in the sacraments. You know, it takes place in lots of different ways and lots of different, you know, with counseling and preaching and spending time with the word, all of that. But really the sacraments is where all that powerful grace is and the power of the Paschal mystery. And so when we are intentional about offering ourselves at Mass, then God transforms us little by little, You know, I talk about this with the process of kneading. You know, when you're kneading dough, it's really tedious. You know, I mean, it's just this physical labor and you're doing it over and over and over again. And what's happening to the dough is happening on the molecular level. Mm-hmm. What's happening is that two proteins, gluten and gliadin, are combining with water to make a long, stretchy protein molecule that's going to wrap around itself and form a network of protein that captures the carbon dioxide produced by the yeast, which makes the dough expand, okay? All of that takes place on a molecular level, and you can't see it happening, and you knead the dough, and you knead the dough, and it feels like nothing's happening, and then all of a sudden, boom! It's like all of a sudden it turns a corner, and the dough takes on this lively quality, and it's this lively, you know, this stretchy, elastic, but also smooth. And you know that the dough is ready then to, you know, to rise. It's ready to get its proofing. You're going to put it in the bowl and let it rest. Well, that process is like our own prayer. You know, it seems like nothing's happening day after day. I'm praying every day, and I don't know if I'm improving. The connections God is making in your heart are on the molecular level. There are these tiny little changes he's making inside you, you know, that take place week after week, month after month, you know, every day going to the Eucharist that we go and that with that tiny different transformation. But eventually we reach this point where we become alive, you know, we become alive in our faith. We become, you know, a batch of lively dough, you know, that God can shape into something. And so that process, you know, it takes time, and we have to be patient with ourselves and with the Lord working in his good time according to his goodwill and bringing us about that transformation, you know, through that sincere self-offering.
Mm-hmm. The way you speak about the Eucharist and the way you just spoke about all that is what I hope to see in more parishes. Sometimes it can seem like people, even priests sometimes, I'll admit, are going through the motions a little bit without the proper reverence and awe.
You know, I can't remember, I think it's Erasmus, was a humanist in the Renaissance. It might have been somebody else, but I think he said, there is none so sacrilegious than the one whose hands have been cauterized by handling holy things. That you become so used to handling holy things, your hands almost become numb to them, you know, and so that's a danger for priesthood. And that's why we need priests who are, you know, who go on retreat, who have a daily prayer, you know, routine, that we have the expectation of our priests that they don't have to be working 24/7 and that they deserve a day off or they deserve, you know, an hour when they're not in the office and they can spend time in private prayer and study. They have enough time to work on their homilies so they can be dynamic and living and not just something they ripped out of a book. You know, we need to make that expectation on priests, but also on behalf of the laity for priests, so they have time to do that sort of thing. And that means that we need to create parishes that are maybe not according to a previous model where Father was in charge of everything. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not a sustainable model anymore. If you're running four parishes, as some priests are, you know, well, then there's got to be, you know, more people assisting so that he can continue to nourish himself. You know, the saying is, nemo dabat quod non habere. You can't give what you ain't got. So if you're not recharging your own batteries as a priest, if you, or even as a minister, I mean, as a lay person, and you don't want to get out there and proclaim the gospel and be a good mom, be a good dad, be a good witness, unless you're recharging your own batteries, unless you're taking the time to renew your life with Jesus, then you won't have anything to give. You know, you do too much out of the goodness of your heart. Eventually the heart ceases to be good.
Right.
You know,
that's right.
And so we have to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves. And it's not a selfish thing. It's actually a generous thing so that I can continue to give. And that kind of mental and spiritual health really is essential. And more as life becomes more frenetic and people's lives become more and more full, that becomes all the more essential.
Incredibly well said, Father. And forgive me for this slight detour here, but hearing the way you talk, I would like to ask, do you in any way, and this is the number one fear of Americans, is do you in any way fear death?
I don't think so. I never really have. I recently, for example, had to have an angiogram, and I did not experience a whole lot of anxiety over it. No, it turned out to be clear, actually, and I'm in good shape, actually. Thanks be to God. But I'm not particularly afraid of death. No, I feel as though I'm not always what I should be, but I'm certainly making the effort to cooperate with God's grace. and that I trust in His mercy that that's sufficient. You know, that you know, my lack of perfection, you know, is going to be, you know, provided for by His grace. And that as long as I continue to try to be as faithful as I possibly can, even when I stumble, even when I'm imperfect, even when I'm not just imperfect, but even sinful sometimes, that I continue to turn back to the Lord with confidence. And that because of that, I'm going to be okay with God. I often, you know, tease people. They say, "Oh, Father Dominic, you're so nice. You're so generous." And, yeah, well, I got a lot of bad karma to burn off from my youth, you know.
Yeah.
but I do feel that, you know, and I think part of that is because I had the example of my mother. My mother died a very good death. She was getting older. She had some health problems. And at one point she had a stroke and went to the hospital. And we had already talked in advance about what she would and would not tolerate, you know, in terms of healthcare. We had like kind of all those hard conversations about, you know, what's moral and what's ethical. And, you know, I kind of did the research and helped her understand that. And she was a nurse, so she understood all the medical processes mm-hmm. perfectly well. And I said, "Well, what about this? And what about this? And would you allow them to do this and such?" And so she knew exactly what was ahead of her. And so after her stroke, she came back out of the stroke and was able to speak for a while. But then she was no longer able to speak. But while she was able to speak, she said, "You know, there's nothing they're going to be able to do for me that I'm going to get any better. You know, and I don't want them to prolong my life unnecessarily so that I'm going to be, you know, in a bed. I want God is going to take care of me and bring me to, you know, whatever it is about. I don't want these various processes she mentioned, you know, and so forth." All of which, you know, were perfectly moral and ethical, you know, and I'd done my homework as a dutiful mm-hmm. son, you know, and she really died a beautiful death that she just gradually said, you know, I've lived long enough and the Lord's been good to me and I'm going to trust myself to Him. And then, you know, she literally kind of fell asleep in the Lord. You know, she stopped responding. But one time her last hours, literally in her last hours, she got a little agitated and my sister Eileen put the rosary in her hands. Now, my mother liked to pray the rosary with her fingers running through the beads, but with the cross in her palm. And we laid that rosary in her hand and she took it and she's not responding. Her eyes are closed. There's no verbal nothing. She took that and flipped that corpus into the palm and smacked it right in there. The most expert thing, a thing she'd done 1,000 times in the dark in her bed, you know,
yeah.
You know, with the rosary, she just flipped that corpus into her palm and we saw the fingers going, you know, wow. And there she was. It was just a beautiful death. She just was a very, very faith-filled woman and, you know, knew that she could entrust herself to God's care and was grateful for all the gifts that she had and was not in any way fearful or resentful or angry. Just, you know, really, she died a beautiful Christian Catholic death. And it was a wonderful example. It really was a wonderful example to us all.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Great answer again. You're pretty good at this. You know, it's not your first time you've done some public speaking or had a public conversation like this.
Well, I'm Irish on one side and Italian on the other. So, you know, I got all the talky ones,
yeah.
all the talky ethnicities, you know, are all right there. So.
Right. Well, let's go ahead and end this conversation with a few easier questions, a few lighter questions and
okay.
some questions that I'm just downright curious to hear your answers to.
Okay.
First of all, when it comes to baking bread and just baking in general, what is something that we can all take from this conversation, take from your advice to improve our skills in the kitchen?
Well, one thing that my mother always told me was that if you can read, you can bake. And so I really recommend people that read recipes and read the whole recipe. Don't just look at the ingredients. Read the whole recipe. Read the notes that go with it. Read the explanation of what is happening in the recipe and why you do that particular process. And if the recipe doesn't give that, find out why. If it says, "Don't use such and such, use this," well, find out why. And, you know, and so that becomes part of your knowledge. And that's really one of the reasons that's made me successful as a baker is that you understand the principles behind the baking. Now, sometimes you just start with a recipe, okay? Easiest recipe in the world, a cup of self-rising flour and a cup and a half of melted ice cream, and you can make muffins.
Really?
You take self-rising flour, one cup, and a cup and a half of melted ice cream, mix those two together, throw in some chocolate chips, you have muffins.
Are they any good?
Oh, yeah. They're only good when they're fresh. They don't keep well.
Oh.
But all the things that are in all of the things that are in muffins are in ice cream, basically, and except for the flour and the baking powder. And that's what's in the self-rising flour. So that's a great place to start. You know, it's just kind of, that's a rainy day thing with your grandkids.
Yeah.
You know, is it raining out? Well, we're going to melt some ice cream and then we're going to make muffins. So that's kind of a fun thing. I grew up in a house where it was normal to be in the kitchen with mom. I appreciate that. And if I were going to say that to anything, you know, don't ever chase your kids out of the kitchen because you're busy. You know, bring them into the kitchen and say, here, beat these eggs. Here, measure the salt out for me. You know, and that really is, it's a bonding moment as a kid learns a skill. My mother made us do fractions in our head. You know, I'm using 3/4 of a cup of sugar, but we're making a double batch. How much is that? And then you'd have to do that in your head. You know, if you were learning to tell time, she'd say, cookies are done in 12 minutes. What time will it be then? Mm-hmm. You know, the kitchen is a classroom. You know,
yeah.
Make that some place where you bond with your children or your grandchildren, your neighbor's kids, your nieces and nephews. That's a great way to make memories.
What do you say to people who say, Father, eating that much bread, eating bread is unhealthy?
Oh, well, here's the first thing. People tell me all the time, well, I used to bake all the time, but now it's just me and my husband. I'm like, do you not have any friends? Seriously? Like, I realize I have, you know, I'm living with 8 bachelors. Of course they all eat tons of bread, you know. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, last night I baked 40 loaves of bread, okay? I gave them all away. I gave them to all kinds of people, you know, because they were little loaves. I shouldn't say they're the giant ones. They were little 10-ouncers. But, you know, when we bake, again, cum panem with bread, you bake bread, it's meant to be given away. You know, that it's one of the ways we show connection. Last night, when I baked that big batch and I realized I really had a few more than I actually needed for the event I had today. So I took a couple of fresh loaves and some butter and some jam, and I took it down to the ER nurses at a local hospital and just dropped it off. One of them happened to be a former student of mine. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, you know, my mom was an ER nurse. I get it. You know, it always helps to have snacks. And so, you know, I brought that off. I drop them off at the fire station sometimes, police station, or I'll, there's guys who are renovating our school right now, a big renovation project happening in the school. I'll send them home with loaves of bread or pastries or caramel corn or something like that. That whole idea of, yeah, you could overeat by eating everything you bake, but better still, use that as a means of showing generosity and love. Absolutely.
Nothing feels better than like when my girlfriend brings over to our family gatherings or just to me, fresh baked anything.
You know what?
It's awesome.
I got a buddy who will not be allowed into the house at his in-laws at Christmas unless he has the Father Dom rolls. Like he gets the Father Dom rolls every year for Christmas for me. And if he doesn't have them, they won't let him in the house. He has to turn around and go home and get them if he forgets them by accident. So yeah, I think bake to share. Absolutely. That should be the norm.
Mm-hmm. Last question here before we close things up. What's your favorite thing to bake?
Oh, no, that's like one of those, who's your favorite child or what's your favorite song or what's your favorite book of the Bible or who's your favorite saint? I mean, I suppose I could, you know, I can narrow it down to probably 5. I will say the thing I make most often is potato bread because we have leftover mashed potatoes from the school. A lot of times I'll have mashed potatoes in the lunchroom. Be a pan left or half a pan left. I will turn that into, I'll turn that into bread. Just because I happen to like it. I love cornbread. I love a good cornbread. My community's favorite is honey oatmeal. I can't make enough of that for them. That's their favorite, kind of bread. If I were going to pick a guilty pleasure, it would be caramel pecan cinnamon rolls, you know, which are a million calories per serving and a year's supply of saturated fat in every serving. But that's a real favorite of mine as well. But the thing I make most often is I make potato rolls. And I make a lot of them for Christmas, Easter, Thanksgiving, holidays. People will call me and say, hey, I got a family reunion. Can I get a pan of rolls? Absolutely, sure. That was where... You know, we're meant to be people of generosity.
Right. Bake to be generous. There's no problem with that. And it's not so bad to eat a little bit yourself. And Father, it's really been a great pleasure talking to you today. I had a lot of fun. We ran out of time, But you are the man, and it sure was interesting. Thank you for your time today.
My pleasure to be with you. Thanks. God bless.
Of course. And thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of Catholic Conversations. That was Father Dominic. Until next weekend, I'm your host, Paul Garcia. And God bless, and have a great week.
You've been listening to Catholic Conversations. Download our podcasts at CatholicSpiritRadio.com.